Please, senor. Not me. Take her. Take my daughter. Jacob looked up at her, away from the child's feet, his mouth still open with laughter, and was struck by the terror in her eyes. His laugh creaking to a close, he shook his head, thinking, God help me, if this is not the most wretched business.
Welcome back to Book Tour and the third part of Toni Morrison's reading from her new novel, A Mercy. We continue with the tradesman Jacob Vark as he leaves the plantation and travels homeward.
He tapped Regina to a faster pace. The sun was low, the air cooler. He was in a hurry to get back into Virginia, its shore, and to Percy's tavern before night, sleep in a bed if they weren't all packed, three or four abreast. Otherwise he would join the other patrons and curl on any surface. But first, he would have one, perhaps two draughts of ale, its bitter, clear taste critical to eliminating the sweetish rot of vice and ruined tobacco that seemed to coat his tongue. Jacob returned Regina to the hostler, paid him, and strolled to the wharf and Percy's tavern. On the way, he saw a man beating a horse to its knees. Before he could open his mouth to shout, rowdy sailors pulled the man away and let him feel his own knees in mud. Few things angered Jacob more than the brutal handling of domesticated animals. He did not know what the sailors were objecting to, but his own fury was not only because of the pain it inflicted on the horse, but because of the mute, unprotesting surrender glazing its eyes. Percy's was closed on Sunday, as he should have known, so he went to the one always open. Rough, illegal, and catering to hard boys, it nevertheless offered good, plentiful food, and never strong meat. On his second draft, a fiddler and a piper entered for their merriment and their money, and, the piper having played less well than himself, raised Jacob's spirits enough for him to join in the singing. When two women came in, the men called out their names with liquored glee. The bawds flounced a bit before choosing a lap to sit in. Jacob demurred when approached. He'd had enough years ago of brothels and the disorderly houses kept by wives of sailors at sea. The boyish recklessness that flooded him at Jubilee did not extend to the sweet debauchery he had sought as a youth. Seated at a table cluttered with the remains of earlier meals, he listened to the talk around him, which was mostly sugar, which was to say, rum. Its price and demand becoming greater than tobacco's, now that glut was ruining that market. The man who seemed to know most about Kill Devil, the simple mechanics of its production, its outrageous prices and beneficial effects, was holding forth with the authority of a mayor. Burly, pock-faced, he had the aura of a man who had been in exotic places, and the eyes of someone unaccustomed to looking at things close to his face. Downs was his name, Peter Downs. A Negro boy had been summoned, and now brought six tankards, the handles of three in each hand, and set them on the table. Five men reached for them and quickly swallowed, Downs also, but spit his first swallow on the floor, telling the company that the gesture was both an offering and a protection from poison. How so? Someone asked. Poison may lurk at the bottom. Never, said Downs. Poison is like the drowned. It always floats. Amid the laughter, Jacob joined the men at the table and listened to Downs's mesmerizing tales, ending with a hilarious description of the size of the women's breasts in Barbados. I once thought of settling there, said Jacob. Besides bosoms, what's it like? Like a whore, lush and deadly, said Downs. Meaning? Downs wiped his lips with his sleeve. Meaning, all is plentiful and ripe, except life. That is scarce and short. 6 months, 18, and he waved goodbye fingers. Then how do they manage? It must be constant turmoil. Jacob was imagining the difference between the steady, controlled labor of Dublio and the disorderliness of sugar plantations. Not at all, Downs smiled. They ship in more, like firewood. What burns to ash is refueled. And don't forget, there are berths. The place is a stew of mulattoes, creoles, zambos, mestizos, lobos, chinos, coyotes. He touched his fingers with his thumb as he listed the types being produced in Barbados. Still the risk is high, countered Jacob. I've heard of whole estates cut down by disease. What will happen when labor dwindles and there is less and less to transport? Why would it dwindle? Downs spread his hands as if carrying the hull of a ship. Africans are as interested in selling slaves to the Dutch as an English planter is in buying them. Rum rules, no matter who does the trading. Laws? What laws? Look, he went on. Massachusetts has already tried laws against rum selling and failed to stop one dram. The sale of molasses to northern colonies is brisker than ever. More steady profit in it than fur, tobacco, lumber, anything. Except gold, I reckon. As long as the fuel is replenished, vats simmer and money heaps. Kill devil, sugar, there will never be enough. A trade for lifetimes to come. Still, Jacob said, it's a degraded business. And hard. Think of it this way. Fur, you need to hunt it, kill it, skin it, carry it, and probably fight some natives for the rights. Tobacco needs nurture, harvest, drying, packing, toting, but mostly time and ever-fresh soil. Sugar? Rum? Cane grows. You can't stop it. Its soil never dies out. You just cut it, cook it, ship it. Down slapped his palms together. That simple, huh? More or less. But the point is this. No loss of investment. None. Ever. No crop failure. No wiped out beaver or fox. No war to interfere. Crop, plentiful. Eternal. Slave workers, same. Buyers eager. Product, heavenly. In a month, the time of the journey from mill to Boston, a man can turn 50 pounds into 5 times as much. Think of it. Each and every month, 5 times the investment, for certain. Jacob had to laugh. He recognized the manner. Hawker turned middleman, eliminating all hesitations and closing all arguments with promises of profit quickly. From Downs's clothes and his apparent unwillingness so far to stand the drinks, Jacob suspected he had not reaped the easy profit he described. Nevertheless, Jacob decided he would look into it. After a leisurely meal of oysters, veal, pigeon, parsnips, and suet pudding restored his taste buds, he reserved bed space with just one man in it, and strolling outside, thought about the disappointing day and the humiliation of having accepted the girl as part payment. He knew he would never see another farthing from Dortega. One day, soon maybe, to everyone's relief, the Stuarts would lose the throne and a Protestant rule. Then, he thought, a case against Dortega would succeed, and he would not be forced to settle for a child as a percentage of what was due him. He knew he had excused the bargain by thinking Rebecca would be eager to have her, but what was truer than that was another thing. From his own childhood, he knew there was no good place in the world for waifs and whelps other than the generosity of strangers, even if bartered, given away, apprenticed, sold, swapped, seduced, tricked for food, labored for shelter, or stolen, they were less doomed under adult control. Even if they mattered less than a milk cow to a parent or master. Without an adult, they were more likely to freeze to death on stone steps, float face down in canals, or wash up on banks and shoals. He refused to be sentimental about his own orphan status. The years spent with children of all shades, stealing food and catching gratuities for errands. His mother, he was told, was a girl of no consequence, who died in childbirth. His father, who hailed from Amsterdam, left him with a name easily punned and a cause of deep suspicion. The shame the Dutch had visited on the English was everywhere, especially during his stint in a poorhouse, before the luck of being taken on as a runner for a law firm. The job required literacy and led to his being signed up by the company. Inheriting land softened the chagrin of being both misborn and disowned. Yet he continued to feel a disturbing pulse of pity for orphans and strays, remembering well there and his own sad teeming in the markets, lanes, alleyways, and ports of every region he traveled. Once before, he found it hard to refuse when called on to rescue an unmoored, unwanted child. A decade ago now, a sawyer asked him to take off his hands a sullen, curly-headed girl he had found half dead on a riverbank. Jacob agreed to do it, provided the sawyer forgive the cost of the lumber he was buying. Unlike now, at that time his farm really did need more help. Rebecca was pregnant then, but no previous sons had lived. His farm was 60 cultivated acres out of 120 of woodland that was located some 7 miles from a hamlet founded by separatists. The patroonship had lain dormant for years when so many Dutch, except for the powerful and wealthy ones, left or were expelled from the region. The land was still isolated except for the separatists. Jacob soon learned that they had bolted from their brethren over the question of the chosen versus the universal nature of salvation. His neighbors favored the first and situated themselves inland, beyond fur posts and wars. When Jacob, a small-scale trader for the company with a sideline in fur and lumber, found himself an heir of sorts, he relished the thought of becoming a landowning, independent farmer. He didn't change his mind about that. He did what was necessary, secured a wife, someone to help her, planted, built, fathered. He had simply added the trading life. Otherwise, he would have to prefer settled farm life and communion with people whose religion dumbfounded him, although the 7-mile distance made their blasphemy irrelevant. Yet, his land belonged to a traveling man who knew very well that it was not wise to have male labor all over the place during his long absences. His preference for steady female labor over dodgy males was based on his own experience as a youth. A frequently absent master was invitation and temptation to escape, rape, or rob. The two men he used as occasional help presented no threat at all. In the right environment, women were naturally reliable. He believed it now, with this ill-shod child that the mother was throwing away, just as he believed it a decade earlier, with the curly-haired goose girl, the one they called Sorrow. And the acquisition of both could be seen as rescue. Only Lena had been purchased outright and deliberately. She was a woman, not a child. Walking in the warm night air, he went as far as possible until the alehouse lights were gemstones, fighting darkness, and the voices of carousing men were lost to the silk rustle of surf. The sky had forgotten completely its morning fire and was tricked out in cool stars on a canvas smooth and dark as Regina's hide. He gazed at the occasional dapple of starlight on the water, then bent down and placed his hands in it. Sand sand moved under his palms. Infant waves died above his wrists, soaking the cuffs of his sleeves. By and by, the detritus of the day washed off, including the faint trace of Coon's blood. As he walked back to the inn, nothing was in his way. There was the heat, of course, but no fog, gold or gray, impeded him. Besides, a plan was taking shape. Knowing full well his shortcomings as a farmer, in fact his boredom with its confinement and routine, he had found commerce more to his taste. Now he fondled the idea of an even more satisfying enterprise, and the plan was as sweet as the sugar on which it was based. And there was a profound difference between the intimacy of slave bodies at Jublio and a remote labor force in Barbados. Right? Right, he thought, looking at a sky vulgar with stars. Clear and right. The silver that glittered there was not at all unreachable, and that wide swath of cream pouring through the stars was his for the tasting. The heat was still pressing, his bed partner overactive, yet he slept well enough, probably because his dreams were of a grand house of many rooms rising on a hill above the fog.
Tomorrow we'll hear the distinctive voice of Florence, the little girl traded to Jacob Vark in exchange for her master's debt. We'll also hear a longer discussion between novelist Toni Morrison and NPR Books correspondent Lynn Neary. For more readings by authors and discussions of their work, visit npr.org/booktour.